Hello, my name is Dave Emery, and this is side one of For the Record program number 619, titled Interview with Paris Flamand on the Anniversary of President Kennedy's Assassination. This program is being recorded on November 18th of the year 2007. It is my pleasure to bring someone to the airwaves, to the For the Record airwaves, that, like Jules Archer, whom I interviewed earlier this year, is one of those people whose work helped to inspire me, literally set me on my life's professional path. Paris Flamand is a man, something of a Renaissance man. He's not only an author, but a radio talk show host like yours truly. And his 1969 book, The Kennedy Conspiracy, about, among other things, Jim Garrison's investigations, primarily about New Orleans District Attorney Jim Garrison's investigation into President Kennedy's assassination, that alerted me to the realities of that event and to some other profound and underlying political realities, and attempting to address those really set me on my life's path. And once again, that path is intersecting with the path of Paris Flamand, and this time, once again, it is upon the occasion of his having published on the subject of President Kennedy. Paris, welcome to our airwaves.
Thank you very much. Glad to be with you.
Now, I wonder, before we talk about the assassination of President Kennedy itself, tell us about your new four-volume series and what is to be found in each of those four volumes and how people can order it. Bear in mind that we can't mention prices on the air.
Right. Well, as you will understand, this will take me about 15 to 20 seconds because it is so voluminous a project. In any event, The Assassination of America, which is its title, is not, quote, another assassination book, unquote. It's, you know, on ballistics or forensics or a specific person of, and regarding the books, of course, there are many, many hundreds of them now. But this is a comprehensive and encyclopedic history of the entire period of the killing of John Fitzgerald Kennedy, and it covers four volumes, about 1,850 pages and 150 pages of photographs, illustrations, of which there are about 450. Book one is about the deaths in Dallas, and that is its title, and covers November 22, 1963, and the time immediately surrounding it. Book two is The Mask of New Orleans, which is an expansion of the earlier book which you mentioned, The Kennedy Conspiracy, which was the history of the first history of the Jim Garrison investigation into the assassination. And it included some of my personal efforts on the district attorney's behalf regarding inquiring into just what was and where was the mysterious international organization Permandex, and the equally strange grouping Centro Mondiale Commerciale. And I also did a lot of research for him into the Old Catholic Church of North America, which seems to permeate various aspects of the assassination, especially in the New Orleans facet. And the third volume, Barren Harvest, explores and explains how Kennedy was killed, why Kennedy was killed, who killed Kennedy, has a summation of those aspects, and 30 definitive appendices on virtually everything you can think of relating to the subject. And this final book, which just came out a few weeks ago, The Indices of the Assassination of America, features a dramatis personae with identification of everybody in the preceding volumes, up to there are 2,300 entries of that nature, a full subject index, an illustration index, a core agenda, and something most people find a little unexpected, six reviews of Gerald Posner's and Vincent Bugliosi's Oswald as the Lone Assassin books, by half a dozen of the major critics, including James DiEugenio and James Fetzer and Josiah Thompson and Gaetan Ponzi, Dr. Gary Aguilar and David Rohn. The entire set is available now.
And bear in mind, we can't mention prices on the air.
No,
but go ahead.
I wasn't going to. I was just mentioning the address.
Right.
And the final, for those who have already bought the first three volumes, and a number of people, of course, have, the volume four is available singly. And they can be gotten through me or the publisher named Scanuscription. It's a little complicated, so I'll spell it. Scanuscription at Post Office Box 48, Scioto, again, odd spelling, Scioto, Pennsylvania, 18354. And I regret to say that I'm not able to handle credit cards, neither are they, but we can take checks or money orders.
All righty, and neither myself nor this radio station gets any money from this arrangement. One of the things about the assassination of America, this really is something of an encyclopedia, not only about key aspects of the assassination of President Kennedy and other American political assassinations, but also about the milieu, my favorite word, that really was responsible for bringing to the American public the truth, the general truth about the assassination. For all of the divisions between various researchers, it was this milieu which you have, to an extent, memorialized. Excuse me, encyclopedic series, that was responsible for alerting the public, including yours truly, to the fact that the official version, as rehashed by people like Gerald Posner and Vincent Bugliosi, is not only wrong, I think a lot of people know that, but it's completely ridiculous and can be fundamentally disproved from information which can be verifiable on the public record itself. And it is that public record that you and the milieu that you memorialized and represented in your four-volume series. Well, basically, that is what you've done. You've made people aware of the reality of American power politics.
Yes. One of the aspects of the set of books is that it points out the enormous number of really egregious errors that have been propounded over the last 40 years, 44 years, actually, almost. And, of course, these recent books that have come out, Posner and Bugliosi, are absolutely rife with errors. And factual errors, not errors of opinion, because one can always squabble about that. But they're simply, particularly in the former, amazing number of basic inaccuracies, as if the person had never even bothered to look at the 26 volumes, which, by the way, I strongly suspect that neither of them ever has.
It wouldn't surprise me one bit. One of the interesting things about the legacy of people on the other side of the aisle from those you memorialized, part of the legacy of people like Gerald Posner and Vincent Bugliosi, who have worked over the years to uphold the untenable official orthodoxy, is that the truth itself remains pigeonholed. A lot of people really do not understand or don't realize at all that in the late 1970s, a congressional select committee, the House Select Committee on Assassinations, investigated the assassinations of John Kennedy and Martin Luther King, concluded that there was almost certainly a conspiracy behind the assassinations of each, and among their recommendations was to, for the Department of Justice to investigate David Ferry and the anti-Castro Cubans in New Orleans. That's who Jim Garrison was after, and the special counsel in charge of the New Orleans phase of the investigation said that Clay Shaw, Garrison's number two target, was certainly involved in the anti-Castro Cuban activities and may very well have been either one of the planners of or one of the cutouts to the planners of the assassination, vindicating Jim Garrison's investigation. Paris, there's a whole generation of people out there who are not familiar with the focal point of your four-volume series or the Kennedy conspiracy, your 1969 opus. How would you go about explaining to some of the younger and or less informed people about the realities of President Kennedy's assassination, starting with this official lie as represented by people, or the official error-filled version as represented by people like Posner and Bugliosi. How would one go about explaining or encapsulating briefly to the uninformed what the reality is as opposed to the official version?
Well, for those who were not born when the tragedy occurred, or those who were too young to be conscious of what was evolving or being disseminated from Washington and elsewhere, it should be simply viewed historically. One should be able to arouse in oneself the interest that one might have in the assassination of Julius Caesar or Abraham Lincoln or the beginning of World War One or Two. It's a major historical event in the 20th century for the United States, very possibly the major historical event of the second half of the century. It is no longer popular to assassinate presidents, but at one time, every president in a 20-year cycle from very early on died in office. Not all were assassinated. A few simply died of natural causes, we may suppose. But a number were assassinated, and that apparently concluded with John Kennedy, because his successors have managed to stay alive. However, the Kennedy case was so complex that it and so dramatic that it will undoubtedly, 100 years from now, stand out as one of the most extraordinary political events in this country's history and probably in the Western Hemisphere. Very simply put, the youngest president ever to occupy the White House was shot down in cold blood on a marvelously beautiful sunny afternoon, just past noon, in Dallas. Although he had been warned not to go there, that there was a great deal of antipathy towards him and some of his policies. And the result was that he not only went there, he not only appeared in a motorcade, but he declined to have the glass bubble that was supposed to be protective placed on the car, for the fact it didn't matter because it wasn't bulletproof, although it has been said that it was, but later information has made it quite clear that it was not bulletproof. And so on that afternoon, the entire history of the United States was changed forever. He had already made it quite clear, and documents have verified that, some of which I've been reviewing just in the last week, that he intended to pull out of Vietnam. He had ordered 10,000 to be removed very quickly, another 25,000 very soon, and everybody out within a year. And, of course, when his death permitted Lyndon Johnson to succeed him, the war was made larger, expanded, and more people were killed. And, of course, it was one of the great disasters of American military history. So one can point out innumerable things that happened either because he wasn't there to prevent them or because other people were. And that is pretty much what I attempt to cover in the four volumes. That's why it's four volumes and not one, because there was so much material. There were so many witnesses. As a matter of fact, in volume one, it covers just the theories that were expounded within the 2 or 3 years after his death, and they number about 30, ranging from the FBI, the CIA, the Russians, the Chinese, and all the way down to magic cults and voodoo doctors. It's unbelievable how impact of this extraordinarily popular president's death was on people of every character and every persuasion. And, well, I think that's about as broad a picture I can paint of it in just, I hope, not too many words.
let's try to do the perhaps impossible, Paris. Let's try to just encapsulate a few of the fundamentals of the forensic evidence. Now, the Warren Commission, the Presidential Fact-Finding Commission, which certainly belongs in quotes, that was in fact there to cover up the assassination, as well as subsequent official versions or semi-official versions, such as the Posner or Bugliosi texts, endorsed the single bullet theory, which in many ways could be said to be the forensic core of the official version. How would you go about encapsulating a critique?
Well, first, I agree with you. That's almost the pivotal. It's there are so innumerable aspects to the case, literally hundreds. Excuse me. But if any one thing might be thought of as the key, it is the single bullet theory enunciated by Arlen Specter, whom, just parenthetically, I think is. Shown himself to be very shrewd, clever, and bright in many of his presentations and speaks well, etc. But this was one of the great mistakes of American history.
Very quickly, Paris, Arlen Specter was the Warren Commission counsel who shepherded the single bullet theory. Now he is a Republican senator from Pennsylvania and under the recent Republican administrations was head of the Senate Judiciary Committee.
Great. Thanks for that explanation. It's important for someone to know just who it was that invented the theory. Well, in any event, it was called Commission Exhibit 399. I don't know why I always thought that number was had an ominous tone to it, even originally. But in any event, it was alleged to have been the single bullet that slew John Kennedy. And if, in fact, any such missile ever existed in actuality. But it was accredited with possessing mystical, even phantasmagorical properties. Namely, it hurtled through two torsi of human bodies and a wrist, inflicting seven distinct wounds, but suffered almost no physical damage or loss of mass, emerging as pristine as the day it was manufactured. Well, anyone who knows anything about firearms or ballistics knows that was an absolute physical impossibility. Furthermore, in its miraculous flight, it clearly altered, it was required to do what the Warren Commission said. It was necessary for it to have altered course several times, which is an aerodynamic impossibility. And all of these details of these fantasies, by the way, are detailed in the work, and there are many photographs that show the condition of the bullets and before it was disappeared and then reappeared. And another thing about it was very curious. After all of this that had been done, that a bullet, I noticed I use A rather than D, was found on the stretcher on which presumably lay John F. Kennedy as he died when he was taken to Parkland Hospital. So the whole story of it is mythic to the point of being fictional.
And we should also mention that bullets often change course fairly dramatically in tissue, in fascia.
Absolutely.
But they don't execute sharp turns in midair without being acted upon by
and
external objects, which is what we're talking about here. We're not talking about something that hits somebody and then travels through the body. We're talking about sharp turns in midair in contravention of the law of inertia.
Right. Absolutely.
And this one bullet has to have been the vehicle for inflicting seven non-fatal wounds on John Connally, the then governor of Texas, and President Kennedy. Otherwise, the fundamentals have to be that there was more than one assassin. Because if you have more than three shots, then you have more than one assassin.
Of course, and if I may parenthesize, John Connolly, who Texan, member of the administration, supreme politician, never bought the Warren Commission report. He always rejected the explanation of the number of bullets and the sequence in which they occurred. So even when you have one of your own men finding that you're fantasizing, then it even makes more questionable, although it's hardly necessary to question the essential absurdity of the mechanics of the entire ballistic pulse. As you say, the seven distinct wounds and changing direction in midair, although not from the impact of anything. The whole magic bullet theory is now, of course, regarded as ludicrous by anybody who understands the case at all.
And there are a great many other discrepancies in the physical evidence of Oswald and his supposed marksmanship itself, including the Mannlicher-Carcano. Paris, do you want to take some time to talk about the Mannlicher-Carcano, or would you like to talk about other things, say, the evidence in the Tippett case?
I think it's important. Next to the 399, it's almost the next most important thing. To begin with, the Mannlicher was a very inferior weapon, a 6.5 caliber Italian rifle, model 1938. Excuse me. It is notably inaccurate, and that particular one, or at least the one alleged to have been found, had improperly mounted sights. One of the most interesting things about that entire revelation of the weapon of assassination was that the Mannlicher was not the first weapon they came up with. Initially, it was described as a British Enfield 303 from World War One. Then they switched it to a German Mauser 7.65, of pretty much like antiquity. Then they should note just parenthetically that the English gun, the Enfield, was said to have been discovered on the seventh floor, not the sixth floor, as we should clarify for those who are not au courant with the mechanics of the case. The Oswald allegedly fired from the sixth floor, but this was discovered on the seventh. However, the following day, Henry Wade, the main Dallas police official, said, quote, "The rifle was not German, as announced the previous day, but Italian. Not a Mauser, but a carbine. Not a 7.6 millimeter, but a 6.5. The revelation to the police force was not unexpected, considering the fact that imprinted on the weapon they produced as the murder weapon was the phrase "made in Italy," also CAL 0.6.5 and the catalog number C.2766, hardly to be expected on a German firearm or a British rifle. So either machinations or incompetence of officialdom that day and the following day was monumental, and no excuse has ever really been made for it. It's been simply slept over as if it were customary in police procedure, and I'm not one to say that it isn't.
We've got just a few minutes left on side one here, Paris, and on side two I'd like to go into the identities of the two lone nut assassins, or so we're told, of November 22nd. First Oswald, of course, or maybe first Jack Ruby and then Oswald. But there was another victim in addition to President Kennedy on November 22nd, 1963. That was Dallas patrolman J.D. Tippit. In the last couple of minutes here, I wonder if you would encapsulate for us some of the discrepancies with regard to the investigation, in quotes, of President Patrolman Tippit's assassination.
Well, there are many curious aspects about the Tippit case. Excuse me. Bill Turner noted, Bill Turner, the very major assassination critic, noted that the officer was clearly singled out for particular instructions, italicized, and plus he made no great haste to get to the assigned scene when he was ordered to go there, rush, rush. He was sent to identify, a curious word that was used on the radio, a 30-ish white male, 5'10", 165-pound individual. He went in that direction, apparently somewhat casually, as we've determined from, well, other sources I won't go into. He turned onto 10th Street, which is the pertinent access at this juncture. It is asserted that he saw a person fitting the description, namely 30-ish, 5'10", white male, and the person came over to his open passenger window to chat with him for a couple of minutes. Tippit then exited his vehicle, purportedly, and walked around the car to speak to the man more directly. The stranger drew a pistol, this is the report, and fired repeatedly at the policeman, hitting him four times. He died instantly. There were various purported witnesses, including T.F. Bowley, who remarked at the time, being 10 minutes past 1, he immediately, with great presence of mind, used the patrol car radio to inform headquarters of the murder. Also on the scene was Domingo Benavides, who subsequently, though pressed, refused to identify the stranger as being Oswald. Aquila Clemens, who was looking out of a window and had some observations to make, was advised by the police to forget what she had seen, knowing anything, as they put it, could be dangerous. Barbara and Virginia Davis were witnesses to peripheral activity on the occasion. And perhaps the most interesting of all was one Helen Markham, who told a series of details, at least 10 extremely explicit details, including how she held the policeman in her arms as he expired, et cetera, et cetera, although we know he died instantaneously. And ultimately, it was demonstrable that virtually everything she said was a fabrication or a misconception, but her value as a witness was ultimately reduced to absolute zero.
And one of the things that we should also note in closing on the subject of Tippit is that there are significant discrepancies with regard to the bullets that were found in his body and the cartridge cases in the weapon allegedly used to kill him.
There are many others. Immediate aftermath, which direction he had been driving just before coming over there, which was in the wrong direction to get to where he was supposed to be assigned. That is a complex and fascinating case in itself, which has only been subsumed by the enormous importance of the death of the president.
We will be taking this up, this subject up, on Side 2 of For the Record Program number 619. This, however, concludes Side 1 of For the Record Program 619, interview with Paris Flamand on the anniversary of President Kennedy's assassination. This is being recorded on November 18th of the year 2007. For Paris Flamand, this is Dave Emery saying thanks for listening.